Caught Offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside. Suburbs of New York City, an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. One half of the Champions League final is secured. Andrew Gunling, JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Oh, the city destiny is assured, Andrew. The lavishly funded project has achieved. Well, it hasn't achieved it yet, but it's one step away from achieving its ultimate purpose.
I'm glad you stopped yourself, because this experiment was not designed to reach Champions League finals.
No.
It was to win them.
Yes, that's for sure. And I think they will win it, whoever they face in the final. But, you know, let's get the old final cliches out of the way, Andrew.
Well,
game of two halves. Anything can happen.
Well, they will be favored.
For sure.
Whether or not they win it, you're right. Who knows? I mean, finals are crazy. But I think you're right. We're guaranteed the fact that they will be favored for that game. We're going to talk, of course, all about what went on this afternoon in Manchester. And we will also be talking later in this podcast about what went on Sunday afternoon in Manchester. Mark Critchley of The Independent, who covers all things Manchester soccer related. He's been on with us before, and he will join us once again for an In the Club, where we go in deep on Manchester United and the events of this past Sunday. And just we've almost gotten a little too accustomed to surreal scenes, but this ranked pretty high on the surreal scene scale.
Oh, and we go deep on it, Andrew. In fact, I think this podcast is the most Manchester podcast we've ever done.
Yeah, you're right. First half blue, second half red.
It's incredible. Before we get into the Manchester City part of things, I just want to wish you a belated happy birthday.
Oh.
I forgot about it on Sunday. A lot of things were happening. I was out watching my team play in Brooklyn. SC Yoa were playing. And as seems to be the case now, whenever I'm watching a live soccer match, real soccer, Andrew, all hell breaks loose in Europe. But somebody did note your birthday. The ESPN podcast did a lovely little picture of you with a graphic. And it just reminded me of the front cover of a struggling stand-up comedian. You're leaning slightly. Your arms are crossed, your foot are folded, and your name is in neon writing. And it just looks like the front cover of a straight to DVD special from like 2002. And I'm trying to think of names for it. I'm going to retweet it to the podcast Twitter, because everyone needs to see this. But I've come up with one, because your face is just like, let's cut the crap and talk about what's really going on in the world. Can we?
Really, people.
Yeah, so it's Andrew Gunling. Can we? A comedy special.
Yeah, it was extremely nice of
very
ESPN
nice
ESPN Pod Center Twitter account to do that. I was pretty surprised. And thank you to everybody who tweeted super nice messages. It was very, very cool. And you will now all be instructed to do the same for JJ this Saturday when he turns a young 48 years old.
just 48, just a breath of a boy. By the way, can I go on record as saying, let's see if ESPN Pod Center does it for me. Yeah, let's see. Not going to happen.
Why is that? Why would they?
You're their golden child, Andrew, clearly.
You know, when I was looking at the picture, like, you were thinking that it looked like some kind of like early 2000s, late 90s comedy special DVD. I felt like, remember how it might have been Family Guy that made fun of this, how like during a broadcast on like Fox or something, they'll put a graphic in the bottom as the show is going on, like a moving graphic will go in the bottom to promote some other show. What
right.
Would it be? Shoving Buddies?
Shoving Buddies, all
and
those things.
Wasn't there also like, what was the other one? This guy. No, that guy, us. Like, it kind of just looked like one of those kinds of promos.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know when you did that promo picture.
It was,
but
you and I did. Well, I think they took half. There's a picture. We had when this podcast first started, we had some kind of like photo shoot in a closet. Remember Jeff Scopin was there. He was snapping shots. Oh, yes. Beautiful, beautiful. And one of them that went unused, I think, was the two of us in the Shovin' Buddies sort of pose with like each of us leaning back to back. And I guess somebody somewhere had access to the full archive maybe of photos, and I think they took one of them.
Oh, that was a photo shoot from hell.
Whoa,
all of those pictures looked
great. We were young and vibrant.
No,
lives ahead of us. Look at us now. We're old and haggard, cynical.
Hey, let's talk about something that you can't be cynical about. And that's Manchester City versus PSG in the semi-final of the Champions League.
I know, with the good guys losing, no less. Manchester City, like we have mentioned, they are through to the Champions League final. And let's talk a little bit about this one. You know, there's a stat that's circulating, JJ, that's interesting. And, you know, coming into this game, if you told me with PSG trailing heading into the second leg that they would not score, it just seemed like such a kind of a, almost a crazy thought. I know Manchester City are excellent in defense with a top line goalkeeper in Manchester City, but it's PSG. Like oftentimes we see them score goals for fun. But for them to not even register a shot on target in this one, I think is perhaps the most jarring element of it. Now,
That was in part due to the fact that, Ruben Dias decided to channel 2005 era John Terry and just throw his head, his broad chest, his whatever at every single shot. And that can kind of distort. If you looked at it at the, you know, the plaudits that have been paid to Ruben Dias for this performance, he was brilliant, as was Zinchenko. Mm-hmm. But that suggests that, you know, this was the Alamo, that Manchester City were hanging on and they, you know, they caught PSG on the break or whatever. That's not really true. PSG did not create an awful lot of chances.
No. The stat is a little bit deceiving because they did hit, Marquinhos did hit the crossbar. Maria did put that shot wide when Bernardo Silva gave it away in a really precarious position.
But it's Tim Gruel, Andrew, isn't it, really?
You're right. You're right. And then you had the blocks. You had Zinchenko had a great block. You had Neymar when he took a shot where you were talking about the Ruben Dias block that was pretty heroic. I mean, that was point-blank range, and it just smashed off of him. Mm. But you're right. Like, there wasn't really a single opportunity for PSG in this game where I said to myself, oh, he's got to score.
No,
and that's rare for them.
It's very rare. And you have to say that without Mbappe, without his pace in behind and his ability to take on players, beat them and open up channels for others with his runs, they were a blunt instrument. And there was far too many times I felt Neymar drop deep again, similar to what we saw in the second half of the first leg. And he gets it and he turns and he's just surrounded by blue shirts and there's nothing ahead of him. And when I say there's nothing ahead of him, one of the most stunningly ineffective performances from a top-level player was delivered tonight by Mauro Icardi. Towards the end of the first half, Jim Beglin, the co-commentator, noted that Icardi was on the field. I had forgotten he had been selected. Like, he was... It's not fair to say disinterested, but he was so... such a sideline to the main event. He was like a bystander. He was like the supporters that couldn't be in the stand. He was observing. His role was almost entirely ceremonial. You know, he's wearing the number 9 jersey. We're giving you the number 9 jersey, but you're not actually going to do anything. Incredible.
Yeah. And it's made all the more glaring by the fact that Kylian Mbappe is not playing. And yeah. Look, I know that no one on this podcast is ever going to shed tears for PSG. All right. We know the money they have, the financial.
You tried
backing.
To once, remember?
I never tried to. But what I will say is, purely as a neutral fan, it is unfortunate that PSG continuously get to these moments. And then, like, it's not like they're missing like a bit part here and there. Like, it's Neymar a couple times. It's Mbappe this time. You know, and the time when they had everybody together is when they were able to make their run to a final where they did eventually lose. But nevertheless, you know, it speaks to the fact that, like, as a neutral fan, I'd like to see a full PSG against a full Manchester City. And so that lacking tonight, I mean, it's no deep insight to say that hurt.
True. There's also other considerations in that the first half of the first leg was as good as I've seen PSG play. And that's not actually true, because again, there were two crucial moments where there were poor touches from both Neymar and Mbappe, when if they got the touch correct in the box, then it's a goal scoring opportunity. I think one skimmed off Mbappe's chest and the other one was a poor first touch by Neymar. But that was a really good disruptive performance from PSG. Like City looked way off it, Andrew, way off it. And obviously Marquinhos scored. But pretty much since halftime in the first leg, it's been City since. And the PSG performance has fallen off a cliff. Now, Roberto Martinez, he said last week that he felt there was an intensity problem, that PSG couldn't, because they're not used to the intensity in their own league, which I'm not sure if that's true, because they've lost, what, 8 or 9 times this season. It's not exactly farmersleague.com. But at the same time, he felt that there was an intensity level that PSG could not maintain and that they were effectively beaten in the first half of the first leg. This was way more comfortable for City than I thought it would be. And the key thing for me with City now, since pretty much after Christmas, is how resolute they are, Andrew, defensively. The worries and the exposed gaps in the armor of City that we saw against Lyon, that we saw against Liverpool, that we saw against Monaco. I'm going through all these ones now. Those are gone. They have a center back that you can say is one of the best center backs in Europe right now. They have a rejuvenated Stones. Zinchenko, he's getting a real note out of Zinchenko when he does play. And I thought Kyle Walker has been much better lately. Certainly much better than he was prior to Christmas. They're much, much tougher. Much tougher of a prospect. And that's the difference, because they're still doing City things. They're still not playing without an out-and-out center forward most times. The cutbacks, your little bink, bink, bunk, bunk, the way they play, the way you describe they play, all that's still there. But what there is now is a resoluteness in defense. And that's why I think they're going to win everything.
Yeah, you're not crazy for saying that. And in talking about both their defense, and we can talk further up the pitch, and their attack, I mean, like I texted you this afternoon, what does it say about them? I guess it can say a few things, but like it's a Champions League semifinal, second leg. And like Raheem Sterling, João Cancelo, like these guys are on their bench. You know, we in the past we would see Aguero and kind of, you know, be stunned by that. That's an afterthought now. Aguero and Gabriel Jesus being on the, like, it just, you wonder almost could City's bench have beaten PSG tonight?
It's a fair thing to wonder. Also, I think it was you. It's certainly not more than a year. Maybe it's 18 months ago. From when you did a piece like, why did City sign Riyad Mahrez? He's fallen off the face of the earth. Remember,
I do not remember saying that.
No, you did. You questioned why or where he was, really. He'd fallen out of favor with Pep. And now look at what he's been doing lately. I mean, he's a key component in that side, particularly since the knockout stage has started. He's playing excellently. The depth that they have. But again, you know, this was planned.
Oh, yeah.
This was...
No, none of this is by accident.
None of it's by accident. If you want to just talk about their recruiting, you can do that. Forget the money issue for the fact that they can't afford these players. Just look at the recruiting. And again, I go to what Roberto Martinez said tonight on CBS. He said there was a lot of talk that they would go for Upamecano or someone like that. But no, an option that suited them better, should I put it that way, in terms of Ruben Dias. And they went out and they got him. They've been so astute in the transfer market in many regards. And it's crazy to me. Again, if you talk maybe like 2 years ago and said Raheem Sterling will not start in a crucial game in the Champions League.
Crazy.
You wouldn't have thought it.
And you say, oh, well, he's hurt. No, he's going to come on as a sub later. But I am glad that you bring that up about Manchester City, what you just brought up a moment ago, because, look, they are one of these, like, villainous clubs. I think we all come to accept that, the way that they have this financial advantage over most of their competition.
Yeah.
Aside from the team that they happen to be on the field against tonight, ironically enough. But, like, look, a lot of teams have tremendous buying and spending power. And it's what you said is important, that like there are teams who have that kind of financial might. We're going to talk about one of them later in this podcast, in Manchester United, that spend and do so oftentimes recklessly. and not to the advantage of what their club needs may be. Manchester City, for the most part, I'm sure we could find some misses over the years, but not many. I mean, it seems like when they go out, they have specific needs in mind, whether it be Diaz at center half, Cancelo at fullback, readying replacements like Rodri and players like that for when Fernandinho starts to decline, having that next guy ready to go. There's not much reckless spending there. When they want someone, they have the advantage where they can get him at all costs. But sure, in terms of targeting those players that they want, they do so pretty thoroughly, and they are being rewarded for it.
Well, that was all part of the plan, getting Ferran Soriano involved, getting Tiki Begiristan. I mean, basically transplanting the Barcelona brains trust and bringing it to Manchester City. I mean, that costs money too. Let's not diminish too much how much the role of Spandulix, as they say, is involved in this whole thing. Also, how about having a goalkeeper who can ping a pass 50 yards onto the toe of Zinchenko in the snow and in the wet, right into his path for that first goal? I mean, that's as good a pass as you'll see from any outfield player. It was absolutely stunning. And as for the second goal, Andrew, the weight on that ball from Phil Foden to Mahrez, the weight, the accuracy was just, it was just unbelievable.
Both goals. And what kind of made them interesting is like both goals were so different from one another. I mean, we talk about the bing bong boom style of Manchester City. The first goal was very much not that. It was just boom, long ball from Ederson.
I think you're doing it a disservice. How dare you just say long ball? It was perfect. Like, if you look at the run from Zinchenko from the halfway,
he pinged it, but it's a long ball.
Oh, it's an absolute ping. Oh, if you could have heard that,
I'm not saying this is Charles Reap stuff, but it is ultimately a long ball.
Yeah, Charles Reap would have been proud. Charles Reap would have been going, you see?
I was onto something. And then look, there was still work for City to do. And they were a little bit fortuitous. I mean, the bounce that took off of De Bruyne's shot was excellently placed for Riyad Mahrez to tuck it home.
Yes.
And like you said, the second goal, it was just beautiful to watch that develop. And you could feel it coming as they were bombing downfield. They had numbers and advantage. And when that's the case for Manchester City, they're ruthless. JJ, just watching Phil Foden, you know, we talked last week about Mason Mount. We've talked repeatedly about Jack Grealish. There's a young core for England that could be really like you. They're not, it's not even that England is that old now necessarily, but you can already see this next wave for England and how good they could continue to be.
What do they do even with the like of Jude Bellingham?
Yeah.
You know, Jude Bellingham, Phil Foden ripping it up in the knockout stages of the Champions League. It's scary. I don't want to take us off topic here, but
let's scary. Let's do a full Euro breakdown right now. Go.
It's concerning to me, Andrew. They may actually go and win something. And let me tell you, you don't want to be around for that.
No, I think it'd be fun. But at any rate, yeah, we don't need to go down that road. A couple notes on this one. Riyad Mahrez, first Manchester City player to score in three consecutive Champions League knockout stage rounds in a single season. Props to him. And we mentioned before, too, about PSG, even though they may have had some close calls, literally for them to not register a shot on target, they're only the second team since in the last 10 years that failed to record a shot on target in a Champions League semifinal. Bayern Munich was the other one in 2015 against Barcelona. So, yeah, wow. If that's a stat that sounds like, I don't think that happens very often. No, it really doesn't. And you certainly wouldn't think it would happen to a team that had Neymar on its roster, but nevertheless, here we are.
On the PSG side of things, Andrew, it was a total meltdown by the end. From the 70th minute on, you didn't feel, certainly when Di Maria got sent off for that just like ridiculous thing that he did.
You can't do it.
You can't do it. I
know that, look, Fernandinho he's very good at a lot of things, one of which is just complete and utter S-housery.
Oh, yeah. He's complete S-house.
He's got a doctorate in that. And like, I mean, it's very easy for me to sit here and just say this as a podcast host, a fan, but like, it's Champions League semifinal. You're still in it. Technically, you can't, I'm sorry, Di Maria, you can't do it. I understand that you're frustrated or whatever, but like, you just, Like, physical mistakes are one thing. Being late on a challenge, like, okay, that's bad, but it happens. This was just a pure mental meltdown in a Champions League second leg semifinal. It's just like, it's just, I don't know how else to say it other than just totally inexcusable.
And again, he's a guy who suffers from the first half syndrome. He was brilliant in that first half of the first leg. And he was, every pass tonight, every attempted shot was just off for him. He had a very frustrating night and it totally boiled over. But again, you saw Neymar's eyes go to heaven. You saw him remonstrating constantly with the referee. Ander Herrera, Marco Verratti, they went into meltdown too as well. Kimpembe could have been sent off. It was bad. And you wonder what happens now in the summer for this team. Like, obviously wages, obviously the financial clout remains. But you wonder, is Pochettino going to move some players on? Are some players going to be on the phones to their agents trying to get out? What of Neymar, who will be, what, 30 next year? You know, I just, where next for this project? And it's so trite, and so many people have said it already, but it does ring true. Manchester City is a unit, is a team, and PSG still, almost, we're well over a decade into this project now, still seems like a collection of individuals.
On some nights.
On some nights, certainly. Yeah.
I mean, there are other nights where, let's be honest, they can be utterly brilliant.
Yeah, but yeah.
Truly fun to watch.
But Andrew, when things, you know, when it was really put up to them in this game, look, I mean, just the way they came out in that second half of the first leg, mm-hmm. I can't get my head around it. Everything was gone. Their pressing was gone. City, now look, City played miles better for three quarters of this game. City upped the intensity and PSG couldn't handle it. That is ultimately the point. But City looked like a finely tuned machine. And PSG were, they just seemed one tackle tonight away from meltdown. And that's what happened.
It really is. One other note on this, for me at least,
yeah,
with regards back to the City side of it, this had to be, of all the people involved for Manchester City, I would think that this was particularly meaningful for Pep. Only in the sense of, like, let's think back, JJ, second leg, Lyon a year ago. Like, his
single leg.
Right, that's right, second leg. There was only one leg. You know, his decision-making going into that, the sort of, like, fear almost that they seemed to enter that game with against an opponent that, look, all props to Lyon. They're not Manchester City. You know, Pep took a beating for that, from fans, from the media, and then for him to sort of carry that negative momentum into the way this season started for Manchester City, you know, there was a thought that it looked like we were in the dying days of his time at this club. And to be at this point now, where he has now beaten PSG in a semifinal to advance Manchester City to their first ever Champions League final, he's waltzing to a Premier League title. A week ago, he won the League Cup. I mean, his own personal turnaround has been remarkable. And I'm not saying he needs it for any kind of legacy building. You know, Gary Neville said after the Carabao Cup that he's the greatest manager of all time. So, you know, I don't know what changes.
He has
tonight,
been anointed.
But he doesn't necessarily need it for his legacy. But just like in the here and now, to watch the way he has kind of re-risen within a span of just months, it's really been impressive to watch. And he has this Manchester City team playing as well as any Manchester City side we have ever seen. And that's saying something, because we've seen some good ones.
I agree with you. There's a few people on Twitter tonight that were saying they didn't think that this was even Manchester City's best iteration under Pep. I disagree.
I don't know. It's an interesting conversation. I don't know that it is. Like, I think about Yaya Toure. I think about Aguero in his prime. What they have 100 points in a season, like,
yeah, but
tough to argue with that. If we're doing our list of the greatest Premier League teams of all time, that one is probably on it.
But Andrew, in, like, again, let's focus on what the big prize here. The big prize here was, like, Pellegrini won a Premier League. The big prize, you know, Mancini won a Premier League. The big prize was to win the Champions League. And
you're,
if you
right,
look,
but you always say the bread is buttered in what you do in the Premier League.
The bread is buttered. It's the bread and butter, for sure. It is the bread and butter. And Brian Clough, I often quote him. He said that that is the thing he would love to win every single season. It was more important to him than anything because it's the ultimate test. I do get that. But to see them come up so short, so regularly, like trounced by Liverpool, knocked out by Tottenham, beaten by lowly Monaco, and then last season by Lyon. I mean, those were pretty humiliating defeats for this project and for this manager, and for them to kind of put that behind him now is huge. It's very big. One note for me before we move on, because it is worth noting, Tarek Panja was back on Twitter today and he dropped an article that you can read at the New York Times. Manchester City battles Premier League over alleged rule breach. So basically the the issues, the financial fair play issues that arose but were time excluded for the Court of Arbitration for Sport and were ultimately thrown out. Well, there's no time exclusion in the Premier League.
How are we just finding out about that, by the way? I was stunned when I read his article that we didn't know about that instantly.
Manchester City are suing the Premier League. So they, suing isn't the correct word. They're taking them to court to make sure that they can't punish them for these alleged violations. So we'll have to watch how this plays out, as well as the punishments that we believe and the Premier League are telling us are coming down the line for the breakaway Super League. So maybe the points deductions that I said shouldn't happen, maybe they don't happen this season, Andrew. Maybe all the breakaway teams are handicapped for next season. Minus 10 points each going into the season.
I'm trying to think of what punishment as a fan of one of the clubs, what punishment would bother you more? A point deduction or a European ban?
Wow. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. A ban from Europe for a year. I don't think I'd like that.
By the way, who's to say that the punishment won't be both?
We don't know. Yeah. We debated punishments last week, so maybe we shouldn't dwell on it too much. But what would bother me most? Maybe the points deduction. No. Ban from Europe outright.
Okay. All right.
Ban from Europe outright would be
at
bad.
Any rate, we're slightly off track. Before we get out, I do, JJ, have one for you.
Oh, God.
All right.
Okay.
If you need help, I'll help you.
Patronize me.
No, these are not easy. These are not easy. Pep Guardiola, seventh manager to reach the Champions League final with two different clubs.
Seventh.
Do you want to try to name the other six?
Champions League final with two different clubs.
To reach a final.
Reach a final. Carlo Ancelotti.
That's right.
With Jose Mourinho.
Mourinho, yes, with Porto and Chelsea.
Otmar Hitzfeld.
Very good. With Bayern and Dortmund.
So how many's left? Three left.
Three left.
What?
Yes, three left.
Three left.
Don't think too hard on one of them.
What am I? Oh, Jurgen Klopp.
Very good. Dortmund and Liverpool.
Okay, go with the other ones. I'm stumped now. I stopped there.
Jep Heynckes.
Oh, Jep Heynckes.
Yeah, and then the other one, JJ. You were very close.
Oh, how can I forget him?
Louis van Gaal.
We go for second place.
Yeah. Yep. Good job, though. That was solid work by you.
Thank you. Off the top of my head, it's as if I haven't been watching this game since 1990.
Oh, so now you have to get smug about it. All right. If you're going to be like that, I would say that you left some on the table there. You struggled with your own Jurgen Klopp. So let's not get too cocky.
Live from Vegas, it's Andrew Gundling with Can We Not?
All right. So congratulations to Manchester City. They are through to the Champions League final, of course, on Wednesday. Second leg of Chelsea and Real Madrid. We will be back with a podcast on Thursday morning, I believe. So you'll probably get it early afternoon, recapping that one. Let's go ahead, JJ. Let's take a break and let's come back on the other side and let us go in the club for Manchester United as we relive the weekend's events. Mark Critchley of The Independent joins us next. Don't go anywhere.
Go, 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 go
Oh, back now we go in the club, JJ, and where else? To Manchester. Mark Critchley of The Independent. He's been on with us before. He's back with us again. He was at Old Trafford on Sunday for the protests, covering it, and he joins us now to talk more about that. Mark, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm good, guys. How are you?
We're good. We're good. I guess first and foremost, JJ and I, we talked a little bit about the scenes at Old Trafford earlier on in the show. And the thing that I think I know the answer to this, but I'm just kind of curious about from your perspective, how is this being viewed and received in Manchester among most supporters? Is it a feeling of pride? Is there a feeling that it went too far? What's the sense there?
I think the former, I was going to say the latter, but definitely the former. I think there is a sense, even among those supporters who perhaps weren't there, didn't take part, because in total, we're talking numbers of about maybe just over 1,000 at both the protests at Old Trafford and at the Lowry, 1,500, something like that. Even those that weren't there, I think there's a sense that this was done for reasons, well, the right reasons. It was justified. It is tapped into an undercurrent of feeling that's existed for a long, long time. I know, obviously, events over the past few weeks with the Super League have kind of triggered it and brought things to a head. But I think generally, even though, you know, I'm sure none of us here and none of these supporters would condone some of the small pockets of violence or some of the kind of petty little incidents of vandalism and stuff that you saw, I think overall people support the fact that this was an opportunity for the fans to get their point across, to make their feelings known, to make their voices heard. And they did that. And I think overall, you know, those who were involved would look back on this and say this was truly, you know, an unqualified success. It was that they went there with the aim of making sure that their point of view was put across, and some of the more hardcore, some of the more militant ones went with the intention of hoping that the game was called off. And like when it was, and I was around some fans when it was, you know, they were all, I don't know, they just thought they would, the sense was kind of like, oh, what a result that is. Oh, that was worth it coming out just to do that. I can't believe that we've managed to, through our actions, managed to get the biggest fixture in English football every season postponed. And that's a huge statement from them. And it has, you know, whatever negative headlines there have been and other stuff at the same time, I think it has got that message across.
Mark, you were at the Lowry where Manchester United traditionally are before games and then they make their way to the ground. What was the mood like there on Sunday?
So I only live like a 2-minute walk away from the Lowry. So I went down, and what was there was about 200, 300 fans in the middle of Trafford Street, stood in the middle of the road, backing up traffic along the way. And they were like singing, chanting, you know, drinking, lighting flares, stuff like that. The mood wasn't, I think a lot of people listening to this, a lot of you listeners, we've seen pictures of what happened at Old Trafford with the fans running on the pitch and a few clashes with police. Mm. It was very different at the Lowry. At the Lowry, there was a tension because you basically had a standoff with police. The fans were stood in the middle of the road and they were blocking off the only road that leads from the entrance to the Lowry onto the main road that the coach could get through. So for as long as they stayed there, there was absolutely no chance of the coach getting up that road and going to Old Trafford and the players leaving the hotel. So you had them in the road, you had the police between them, and then you had the coaches behind. And the mood was just among the supporters was, you know, kind of jovial. Like I said, there was, you know, people are, it's a bit of a party atmosphere, but at the same time, there was a certain defiance about it. You knew after a while that unless the police stepped in and tried to disperse this crowd, that they weren't going anywhere until they heard news that, you know, kickoff had been delayed or the game had been postponed. And indeed, I think I kind of left halfway through because it was clear that, you know, there was going to be no movement and I needed to get to the game in case it did go ahead. But by the time I got back, you know, they had stayed around a little while after as well. Once the postponement was announced, they were still there. They were still kind of defiantly singing songs, stuff like that. And I think, you know, like I said, all the stuff at Old Trafford was all over the news bulletins. It was all over the BBC News main thing at 10 o'clock that night. That was the image of the day, if you like. But that protest at the Lowry was the one which really meant that there was no chance of the game going ahead as long as those fans stayed there. And you know, it was disciplined, it was organised, and it was, you know, from their perspective, successful and actually quite impressive for that fact as well.
So, Mark, the of course, the focal point of this are the Glazers. And the question that, since this idea of the European Super League has come to the forefront, you know, JJ and I have talked a lot about club ownership. And the question we keep coming back to, because all of these figures now at all of these clubs involved, they're despised by their fans at each one of these places. And the thing we keep wondering is, do they care? Are they willing to be hated as long as they can keep collecting money? What is the sense that you get from the Glazer family? Do they care about the way fans feel about them and about these scenes that occurred over the weekend?
I think that they would want to have a better relationship with Manchester United supporters. I'm sure of that. It's not ideal, the situation as it has been. But then at the same time, there's been 15 years of this. Like I said, all the events of the weekend and what you've seen over the past couple of weeks since the Super League, with the fans going to the training ground even and confronting Solskjaer, that is all part of an undercurrent that's existed for 15 years. And, you know, if the Glazers genuinely wanted to try and engage and to try and come out and, you know, be more open, more lines of communication, and Joe Glazer had in his statement after the Super League, he talked about rebuilding trust. I don't think that trust has ever been there. And there hasn't been, to be quite frank, there hasn't been a lot of many attempts from the family's perspective to really communicate. I think there was one interview that was done in 2005, I think, with Joe. I might be wrong on that. It's one of the brothers, shortly after the takeover, where he actually said, you know, communication was important and it was something that they would look to do. But that's the only on record interview I think that they've done since the takeover, so it's not been there. United do have like recourse for fans to engage with the club. They have fan forums that they hold once or twice a year, regular intervals. Ed Woodward attended an emergency one that they had last week after the Super League, so there is that. But you know, you talk to these supporters, you talk to these fan groups, they don't feel like they're listened to, and that's why it results in things that happen, what happened at the weekend. They feel that they need to organise these demonstrations and these protests in order to make their feelings known.
Mark, I've seen a few journalists, including your colleague, the Right Honourable Tony Evans, kind of frame what happened on Sunday as, and I'm paraphrasing, a last desperate kind of show of anger against something that was lost or taken away from them 16 years ago. Is that a fair summation of what we saw at Old Trafford? And I suppose that the next question to that is there legs? Is there somewhere to go with this now for the supporters?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Tony's kind of conclusion was that this is all great, but it's almost come 16 years too late. And I think that's a fair assessment of the situation. You know, like, the opposition's always been there. Like I said, there's always been that undercurrent, even among, you've got the hardcore, you've got the militant groups that want to be doing this kind of action all the time. Then you've got fans that will join in. There was a lot of young fans at Old Trafford the other day. They're kind of jumping on this as the waves come and go, you know, and you've seen instances before, like in 2010 when they had the green and gold stuff. It comes in waves, you know, and I imagine maybe this will die down, maybe it won't, but if it does die down, there'll be another one in a few years' time. I think the atmosphere around the club was actually quite tetchy. If you think back just a few months before the first lockdown last year, there was some chants and, you know, songs about Ed Woodward and the Glazers at games. Mm-hmm. So you're always going to see that ebb and flow, I think. But in terms of whether it's ever going to come to an actual end point where the Glazers are going to, you know, sell up and we can, United fans can push through this fan-led ownership or whatever the aims are, 50+1. I think, you know, it just looks unrealistic for now, because the bottom line is that the Glazers have no intention in selling up, and they're quite happy with it. I think at the minute, if you look at the share price, the valuation of the club is around £2 billion. So, you know, take that, then they'd need convincing to sell, because they don't want to sell. So you mark that up a bit, you factor in all the debt, you're talking about 3 or 4 billion, and you start thinking, well, who are the players who are able to still put that type of money in this market? Who wants to spend it on a football club? And I don't know. Like you look around world football, you've got like City, PSG. They're owned by nation states essentially. You know, it's not quite this like that with City, but you know, we're talking about Qatar, Abu Dhabi. There was interest there was links with Saudi Arabia and United a couple of years ago. That the club always said that was just an ownership, and that came to nothing ultimately. But you've got, I don't know, maybe tech billionaires or something like Arsenal with Ek, this whole thing that's got a consortium, maybe, like was in 2010 with the Red Knights and some wealthy fans getting together and former players and stuff like that, but it'd have to be a lot of people coming together at once. I think the chances of that happening anytime soon as it stands are unlikely. The chances of making the Glazers sell are unlikelier still. And it's a difficult situation. I think the key thing could be TV and broadcasting rights. I think that's the area where not just the Glazers, but all these other clubs, all these other owners that were involved in the Super League. I mean, what was the Super League in the end? It was an attempt by them to secure the money that they would get from broadcasting rights for competing in the Champions League and get it every year and guarantee it, whether they, no matter how well they did in the league. So, you know, at the minute, that kind of broadcasting revenue, it's stagnant. I think the Premier League are going to get maybe a rollover on the current contract. Unless that goes up in a few years, unless some big like tech company like Facebook, Amazon, Google, whoever comes in to like really increase those rights, maybe then not just the Glazers, but other club owners look at it and think this isn't really a growth model anymore. There's not a lot of potential in this, and maybe it's time to sell up. Maybe that's the key further down the line. But for now, it feels like it's made the fans' voice clear. We know they're unhappy. You know, they've had their say, but in terms of actual practical material change, it's still difficult to see how that happens.
Mark, I wanted to go a little bit deeper on the fans' feelings for the Glazers, because I guess generally speaking, you know, a fan base will develop a hatred for ownership when they're refusing to spend and invest in talent for the team. That is not necessarily the case here. Pogba, Lukaku, Di Maria, there are certain marquee signings from over the years that we can certainly point to when it comes to their activity in the transfer window. So I'm just curious from your viewpoint on the list of grievances that fans have with this ownership, what are the top items on that list?
I think number one is the debt. It is the debt, and what that has meant is possible at Old Trafford and at United over the last 15 years. I think, you know, it's something that people, some of the pundits that have spoken about it in the last few days haven't been completely on top of it. So it's worth trying to give a basic overview, and I'll try and do that. Mm. So when they took over, it was about £800 million takeover. A lot of that was in loans, which was secured against the club. So it meant that the club, which had been debt-free since like 1931, was suddenly about £600 million in debt, and they were having to pay interest on top of that. Now, if you add all that up, if you add all the interest payments, some of the debt repayments, because some of that has been paid off, if you add the dividends that are paid to the Glazers as a kind of, you know, annual payment, like dividends for shareholders at most companies, if you add all that up, it comes to about £1.1 billion that has been spent on managing that debt. To put that in context, United have spent £1 billion in terms of buying and selling players over that same period. So it's actually more than they've spent in the transfer market. So, you know, it's a fair point that, yes, they've spent money on Pogba, yes, they've spent money on Di Maria, et cetera, et cetera. They broke the world transfer record under the Glazers. But over that period, more money has been spent in terms of servicing the debt that the Glazers used to buy the club, to own it, rather than on players or whatever, on improving Old Trafford, in building the training ground, something like that. So that is... that is a huge bugbear of the fans. That is the main one, really. It's almost asking, what could have that money been put towards? How much more successful could we have been if that money had been used? Is my is the price of my season ticket or whatever, or the ticket I go to early away matches, or the pie or the program or the whatever, the shirt that I buy, is all that just being used to pay for, you know, interest payments on this debt that the Glazers used to take over the club? And, you know, like, debt isn't something that is totally bad. You know, there's other clubs are in debt. Liverpool are 260 odd million in debt. You can be in debt and manage yourself as well as a football club. But I think, and the fact that I should mention as well, that debt was restructured around 2010, 2011. So it means that a lot of the high interest ones were paid off, and a lot of that 1.1 billion that has been spent on servicing the debt was spent in the first 5 or 6 years of the Glazer ownership. So it's manageable now, is what I'm saying. But even so, so much money over the past 10 years, more than any other Premier League club, all the other Premier League clubs combined, has gone on that. So that's what the fans are asking. They're asking, where could that money gone otherwise? Where, you know, how could that have been reinvested? So that's the main one. That's a huge one. And it's important to understand. But I think then other than that, the other complaints would be, as I said before, communication lines don't seem to be excellent. You know, you look at, for all the faults and for all the times they have to come out and apologise for stuff that they've done. The Liverpool's owners, John Henry and all those, they've generally built up a lot of goodwill with the Liverpool fan base, haven't they, until maybe the past few weeks. It's not the case like that at United. There's never been that kind of open line of communication. And then also, I think just generally, although there's been a bit of pushback to this idea, and I don't think that... It comes down to success as well, is what I'm saying. I know a lot of people have pushed back on that idea. And United fans were unhappy with the Glazers, even when they were successful under Ferguson. I think that it does come down to the fact that, you know, if the team isn't succeeding to the level it should be, and they've had a good season, but, you know, they could get in a Europa League final on Thursday. Is that really success for a club of the size of Manchester United? You know, is that the standard that we should be judging them to? They've got, what is it? Is it... Well, they haven't won the league title since 2013, and I think they've failed to qualify for the Champions League 3 of the last 7 seasons. That isn't, for a club their size, for a club that turns over 600 million a year, that isn't really successful. You know, that should be more and less guaranteed and secure. So that does play a part in it as well, even though I think the opposition has always been constant, whether the team's winning or losing.
Mark, I just want to expand it for a second and look beyond maybe the borders of Manchester. Do you sense Dave Jones on Sky asked rather plaintively to Gary Neville at the weekend, we don't want to see matches called off regularly, do we, Gary? And I'm not sure that a lot of supporters seen the success or the relative success of what United fans did. Supporters who are, you know, if Arsenal are watching this, if, say, for example, maybe elements of the Liverpool support are watching this. Do you think that there is a mood in England for this kind of mass demonstration generally, or are these some specific kind of unique cases?
I think that there are, I think United's case is particular and unique, and there are elements not only within the situation with the Glazers, but there are elements within their support that are perhaps sometimes a little bit more militant than at other clubs. That not all other clubs, but than some other clubs. I think you know, there's almost a history of this. When the Glazer takeover was going through in 2005, you had fan groups invading the race courses and, you know, the reserve team matches, and they even hung an effigy of Malcolm Glazer whatever you think about it. There's always been that element, that undercurrent within the United support. So it is particularly in that way. But at the same time, I think what you've seen over the past 2 or 3 weeks, particularly with the Super League, was fans of all different clubs, all different support bases, coming together against a common kind of, not enemy, but something, you know, something that they just, all of them opposed. And it was that fan power, if you like, that opposition was part of why that project so spectacularly collapsed. It was one of the main reasons why it spectacularly collapsed. So there is certainly the potential there, but I am always, you know, whether you say you're optimistic or pessimistic about it, I am always slightly skeptical as to whether when things come to the crunch, whether, you know, I can't imagine a lot of Manchester City supporters lining up beside United supporters at the next Glazer demonstration, for example. It just doesn't cut along those lines. You need, like I said, a common enemy, and the Super League was that.
Right.
But I'm just skeptical of the potential. I'd happily be proved wrong, but it doesn't feel like this is a moment where everyone's going to fall in line behind United fans. I think from some of the reaction, there are supportive elements of other support fan and fan groups, certainly, but I'm skeptical. I think it's usually the club supporters itself that have to take it on themselves and have to fight their own fight.
Do you think this is the last United postponed match that we'll see, or is there a feeling that this is going to continue until there's some tangible change?
Well, I was asking around yesterday, and from some of the more kind of established supporters groups, there wasn't too much of an appetite for another protest at the next game, for example. Okay. Yet, mm-hmm. I think that what they wanted to now focus on was more kind of, you know, pressuring government, going through official channels, this fan-led review into football that's happening in this country in a few months' time. They, you know, start focusing on that. But one of the things about Sunday was that it was a lot of different groups coming together, and like I said, of a lot of different kind of, I don't know, some more militant than others, basically.
Yeah.
And one thing that I thought about what happened at the Lowry, where I was saying it's so important as well, was that was a relatively simple thing to do. It was, you know, it was just 200, 300 people, not even that many really, to organise at short notice in terms of the United's fan base, stood in the middle of the road blocking off an exit. Now, you know, I'm sure United will change up their plans. There'll be added security and the police will be aware of that now as well. But I wonder whether you might see smaller, but, you know, maybe even more organised, more targeted, I don't know, types of protests popping up. There are people on social media saying, let's do it for this game, let's do it for that game. And, you know, I don't know whether it'll come together for in something that as big as you saw on Sunday, because it might not have the backing of all the fan groups. But I wouldn't rule it out at this point.
Mark, there'll be no repercussions for those who went onto the field. What's the state of play with that? There'll be no, criminal charges against any of them, or what are we hearing about that?
No, the understanding from the club is that they won't be going after any fans that, first of all, peacefully protested. I don't think there's going to be any kind of, they're not in any sense going to go after fans who ran onto the pitch. I think what any kind of disciplinary measures, whether it's like kind of corroboration with the police and I don't know, banning stadium bans or whatever, I think that's going to focus on anyone that they can identify was involved in actual criminal behaviour. That was the understanding yesterday. I don't know. It's tough because, like, usually if you saw something like that happen, you would expect, you know, people who, if you were a streaker at the United game and you ran on the pitch, you might get a lifetime ban. You know, that's the way. Yeah. It's usually the way it is.
Yeah.
But I think almost I don't want to call it a consensus because I don't think it's a consensus, but the fact that you've got people like Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher and Roy Keane on Sky Sports not condoning everything that goes on, but tacitly supporting the motive behind the protest, and I think that is a factor in how what happened on Sunday will be viewed. And, you know, people are, I think generally, I'm speaking generally, but people have looked at that and have understood that their frustrations, and this was a group of supporters who were looking to, you know, express their voice and have legitimate grievances. And the crackdown, if you like, is not going to be as hard as it otherwise might have been. Like, you can still debate whether it's too harsh or I don't know, but it's another debate. But it feels like there is a general understanding that these fans had legitimate cause, and you know, what they did was part of themselves expressing their voice and their opposition to the Glazer ownership.
Mark, last one from me. So, okay, let's pretend that you're the Glazers for a second here.
Okay, cool.
The position everyone wants to be in.
Yeah. So you are not going to sell the team. Short of that, what is your first step that you would take to help this situation? Or if we basically just cross the threshold where there is just simply no coming back from and everyone can just kind of remain dug in on their sides?
That's tough. I think you've kind of, like I said, the feeling has been so strong for so long that it's going to take a lot to get them back on side. I don't even know if it's possible, to be honest, being truthful with you. The feeling is that strong, but I feel like opening up lines of communication, first of all, would be a step in the right direction. I think, you know, you saw the apology after the Super League, and that didn't quite strike the right tone for a lot of United supporters that I've been speaking to, that, you know, their impression has been that it was almost like a non-apology, if you like, and it just went over. So fixing that, first of all, would be the first thing that I do. But like, aside from that, it's difficult because like I said, you said before, what is a good owner? Well, it's somebody who, for a lot of fans, it's somebody who will spend a lot of money in the transfer market to improve the team. And as long as results are okay on the pitch, people generally are fine with all the financials and how the club's run. But I do think that the opposition to the Glazer ownership among a lot of United supporters, an increasing amount of United supporters, go beyond that. You know, they see past that. That green and gold protest in 2010 was, I think Jamie Carragher was pointing this out on Monday Night Football last night, it was a year after they were in the Champions League final, and they were in the Champions League final the year after as well. It's not contingent on success. It does go deeper than that. And how you turn that tanker around, I honestly don't know. And I don't earn as much money as Joe Glazer and the Glazer family have in their lifetime to be paid to know that answer either. But yeah, that's the first thing. The first thing I'd do is open up lines of communication. Oh.
Mark, if we could only get a time machine and we could go back to 2003 and we could tell Alex Ferguson, don't annoy Magner and McManus over a horse.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a bit of horse semen, you know.
It's all about horse semen. That's exactly what it comes down to.
It's just a bit of horse semen. It doesn't matter. In the grand scheme of things,
it's like that line from Sopranos, except change it out. Horse semen and the Glazers have brought us to this.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to have to explain that to some people when in the next part of the pod. I will explain what I'm talking about. This is not an inside joke between me and Mark. This is a well-known established fact that United have been brought down by horse semen.
Well, Mark, thanks so much. This has been fascinating, and we'll of course continue to cover this, and should events continue to transpire much like this, I'm sure we'll be speaking with you again. Thanks so much, Mark.
Cool. Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me on. Cheers.
That was a great chat with Mark. That was really, really interesting. We should probably address the horse in the room. So horse semen, Andrew, how does this all tie into what we're currently experiencing as we watch Manchester United and what we saw on Sunday? Well, there was a horse, Andrew, called Rock of Gibraltar. And it was, how shall I put this? Alex Ferguson thought he owned it. Or he part-owned it with two shareholders, JP McManus and John Magner, two major shareholders in Manchester United. And when it came to the studding rights for this horse, Alex Ferguson believed he was owed a lot of money. And it got turned out to be a legal debacle that went all the way to the Irish High Court in 2003, 2004, in around that time. And this was the backdrop to JP McManus and John Magner selling their 29% stakeholding in the club. And that was being monitored by Malcolm Glazer and the Glazer family. And that opened the door for the Glazers to come in, buy the shares from Magner and McManus, and ultimately to launch their complete takeover of Manchester United.
Incredible.
And at the time, Alex Ferguson was said to be repulsed, that's a quote from the Irish Times, at the idea of what the Glazers were doing in terms of loading the club with debt to buy the club. But it was really, Roy Keane told the manager in his role as club captain, he told Alex Ferguson, this is not good to be falling out with shareholders like this. This row, this public row isn't good. By the way, it was a gentleman's agreement that Ferguson had with Magna that he owned part of the horse.
Those are always very tenuous.
Nothing written down. There will be lawyers.
Oh, yeah.
And there were. And I'll never forget. I guess I didn't join the dots until recently. This huge row between Magna and Ferguson opened the door, ultimately opened the door for the Glazers getting involved. So when we said if we could jump in that time machine and go back and say, Fergie, don't get involved in this. But it's interesting because, you know, by the end, I mean, Alex Ferguson was still a very powerful figure at Old Trafford, and he moved from allegedly being repulsed by the idea of the Glazer taking over to what we'll hear now at the end of his time at United, when he was he'd retired a Manchester United manager and he was doing his book launch, and he was interviewed by Channel 4's Jon Snow. He was an ardent defender of the Glazers.
They supported the manager, they supported the club and all the improvements are made. You look at the training ground today, that's down to the Glazers. Fantastic training. It's probably the best training ground in Britain. And it gives the club, and I said this last year, maybe it's the best thing we've ever had, is producing the medical centre. It's absolutely fantastic.
But they've also produced a debt, the like of which nobody would want to sleep very easily with, 400 yeah. million.
Well, that was 700 million.
No, it's still a lot.
Yeah, but don't forget, any takeover in business is done with debt.
Do you mind the money in football?
I think it's an area of... the Platini is trying to bring in, and it's quite right, about financial fair play, but I don't know you can control it.
But it can't just go on like this, can it?
Well, you wouldn't think so.
And again, here's another one from the same interview from Fergie.
That's in a way why you like the Glazers, because they've left you with control. They don't really control the club, you do.
But they're supportive. That's the important thing. I think that you always appreciate people who support you, and they've been very good. And they're very... everything they've asked for, they've delivered. So what can you do? I think it's the right thing to do.
So it's, I mean, I'm not laying the blame solely at Alex Ferguson's door, but as the most powerful man in Manchester United, you know, he defended the Glazers a lot, much to the chagrin of a lot of supporters, but it didn't matter what Fergie told the supporters. It didn't matter when he said he believed that they should get behind the club. They've been steadfast for 16 years in their opposition to this ownership.
So I feel like we need to talk about that. And I know we just spent about 25 minutes talking about it with Mark, but JJ, I'm going to be honest. My American brain is running wild right now.
Okay.
There's a lot to this that is fascinating. And I've tried to dive into this as much as I possibly can, not just in the last couple of days since all this went down, but
right.
I mean, really, we've seen this building for years, for over a decade, essentially since they signed the paperwork.
Yeah.
And you know, I keep kind of bouncing back and forth. Okay, like you've just pointed out, a club legend, I mean, maybe the most important figure in the history of Manchester United seems to be, and Alex Ferguson appears from these interviews and from other interviews, appears to be a pro-Glazer guy. He can't get the people on side. No. His word on this does not matter. Okay, fine, fair enough. Everyone's free to think for themselves. Then I go to the next thought of, okay, well, you know, they have won during the Glazers' time. They've won a Champions League final. They've been to another Champions League final. They've
right.
won Premier League titles. Okay, so like the winning that went on, that hasn't gotten the fan base on side. And then I keep going and I keep thinking, okay, well, what are other things that fans generally hate about ownership? You know, especially an ownership group like this that is in debt. Okay, well, is their debt causing them in some way to not reinvest in the squad? Well, for one, you heard Alex Ferguson in the one clip there talk about how Manchester United have arguably the greatest training ground in all of Britain. And then you go to what they've done in the transfer window. And like Mark mentioned to us, JJ, they spent $1 billion on transfers. I mean, guys like, you know, we know the Martial, Lukaku, Pogba, Di Maria, you know, even Harry Maguire. You know, that was a massive, like, they, and it was interesting to me because Mark mentioned how, you know, they've spent $1 billion, but they've also spent $1.1 billion to service their debt. Imagine what that money could have been used on. That's true. That is certainly a good point that I would not argue with. My head also, though, simultaneously went to a place of they're in that kind of debt and they've still spent $1 billion on bringing in this kind of talent. I mean, that's that's remarkable in its own right. I don't know of many. I mean, look, JJ, look no further than where we are in New York. When like the Wilpons with the Mets were going through their issues with the Bernie Madoff scandal and how it crippled the team, and you know, because they couldn't spend on players because of what they were dealing with financially behind the scenes. So like, that's more of what I'm accustomed to. These guys still did spend. So, you know, in my head, those are three key strikes here that you would think might fall in the Glazers' favor in terms of how they're viewed by supporters, which don't. So, there has to be something far deeper to this hatred. And I've been trying to pull up the threads of what that is. And I hope this isn't too salacious to say. And I think it'll make sense as we talk more about it. But I can't help but think that there is some sort of anti-American sentiment in this. And I'm not trying to be... I'm not trying to paint Manchester United in any kind of light. And I hope I'm not being too American centric in my own right in saying that, but I just can't help but feel in this. And in this instance, the Glazers are American. If they were Australian, if they were South African, whatever, maybe I shouldn't say anti-American, just almost an anti-English sentiment, that there is these supporters feel that this is a thing that should belong to them.
Yes.
And in some way, it has been taken from them by someone who is not from there, who never shows up there, who has never really made any effort whatsoever during, you know, throughout this time period of difficultness between the fan base and the ownership group over years and years and years, never really made an effort to mend those fences and has taken this thing that belongs to Manchester and has made it global and has kind of taken it in a direction that is not, that is no longer indigenous to Manchester, and couple all of that with what just happened in the European Super League, which essentially confirms all the fears that Manchester United supporters had about an American coming in. And this is where we are. It all built to this moment and this protest and a game against Liverpool being postponed over the weekend. And so I hope, maybe you'll agree, maybe you'll disagree, but I can't help but think that all those other things, transfers, winning, Fergie, whatever, none of it matters because this guy, this Glazer family is not one of them, the fans.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. There's so much of what you said there I agree with. It's a sense of alienation, Andrew. These are people for whom Manchester United is not a club to support. It's not just a football team. It's not the wins and losses. It's not top of the table. It's their everything. When they wake up and they can see the ground, or they're in the shadow of the ground. You know, the people that were protesting there on Sunday aren't from Los Angeles. They're not from Des Moines. They're not from Jakarta. They're not from Johannesburg. There is a deeper connection to them because this is part of their community. The connection to the club is visceral and it's real. And they've been disassociated and alienated by the moves of this owner. So it's not for them. It's like there's a view of the modern fan that it's the guy who's the reply to John Henry. When John Henry puts out his mea culpa video, what's the first thing you see below it? Some Liverpool fan from somewhere, I don't know where, writing, sign Mbappe and everything's fine. These fans are not like that. Their connection is like what you said. It's deeper. And globalization has changed the game. Now they have to, I suppose they feel, it's not about sharing so much. Manchester United has always had foreign fans, but now they feel like those foreign fans, Americans or people from India or people from the Asia or wherever, Korea, wherever, that they're being pandered to by TV deals, that they matter more and that the local fan can't get into the ground anymore. And it's been coming a long time since the beginning of the Premier League, Andrew, the way things have, the ordinary fan has been priced out. You know, it's harder to get into grounds now because there's tourists there. There's people there with their cameras down the front, and they come from all around the world, including my own country. And they don't always know the songs. They're not hardcore. They don't live it. Do they go to the away games? No. The hardcore fans is almost always the away section. Those guys that pop off in the corner of wherever, going absolutely mental after their team scores, that take the day off work so they can drive up. That they, you know, and those are the people you saw there. And yeah, a lot of it was fueled by drink and some of it was unsavory. But for the most part, this is them letting their emotions out. This is the culmination. The last, like what I said to Mark, is this the last desperate act of people who've been had something precious to them taken away incrementally? It's been death by a thousand cuts for supporters. I mean, what the Glazers did prompted a new club to be founded, FC United of Manchester, that got to like the seventh tier of the English football pyramid. That's where it's coming from. And it's, you know what? It's, some of it is socioeconomic as well. Like in their lives right now, there's a lot of uncertainty, you know, since Brexit in 2016. COVID-19 pandemic has meant they've been shut away from what they love so much. And now they can't even go into the ground to protest. Well, they did. They took back some of that ownership that they feel they have over the club. And Jamie Carragher, I'd echo his words as well. Nobody wants to see policemen hit. Nobody wants to see horses hit. Nobody wants to see bottles broken. Nobody wants any of that. I shouldn't have to say this, but the vast majority of fans and protesters, just what Mark was telling us and what Jamie Carragher said, don't view them as football thugs. These are people who care deeply on a level I don't even care for my club for. Honestly, on a really deep level. And that manifested itself in an attempt at taking back some piece of their club on Sunday.
Here's one of the problems that I now foresee for Manchester United. Look, the Glazer family and the damage that they've done, like Mark said to us, there may be a threshold that's been crossed here that can never be repaired. I asked Mark, what would your first step be if you were them and you were going to repair this? And he had a hard time finding an answer because we're beyond repair. But like the phrase that we keep mentioning from the Who, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Who is it that this fan base thinks can come in and fix this?
Right.
And look, I know that they tried to put together, when was it? Was it back in 2010 where supporters had thought that they had found some local
businessmen and
truly wealthy Manchester people who were going to be able to do this. But Manchester, I mean, their financial might, I think, is somewhere in like, what is it? Like the $3.5 billion range, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
There's a select few people on earth that can afford something like this. I mean, we're talking about Jeff Bezos. We're talking about people like that. So is it going to just be meet the new boss, same as the old boss? And I tend to think it will be. I mean, and by the way, it also bears mentioning too, you know, Mike Ashley, I mean, he was supposedly a Newcastle fan, right?
Yeah, from London, however that works. He also bought part of Rangers as well. So Mike Ashley seems like a businessman.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
But no. In truth, though, the fan model as an owner, it also doesn't always work.
It doesn't, but at least you're responsible. That sense of agency, Andrew. I mean, they were not consulted about anything. And we've seen Chelsea today who have said maybe it's just an olive branch to supporters. But they said they're going to appoint three supporters to be in consultation with the board going forward. You know, the Glazers don't show any of that kind of...
Right.
Olive branch, as I said, they don't seem to be looking to ameliorate the situation at all.
Well, I've always, I mean, the term that I use, willing to be hated. I mean, they're, whenever I utter that phrase, they're kind of the faces that I, in my head, I'm thinking of. It could be Kroenke, it could be Enoch at Tottenham, but like, I'm always kind of picturing the Glazers.
We have a piece of audio from 2005, Andrew, because some people have been vocal in saying, usually rival fans, if United were winning Premier Leagues, you wouldn't see any of this. Well, you saw it even before the Glazers had a chance to sit down. And here's Bobby Robson, Bobby Charlton, who was on the board of Manchester United at the time, a club legend, meeting the Glazers and trying to smooth over a protest and violence that had broken out at their arrival in Manchester. This is from MUTV in 2005.
Ever the diplomat, Sir Bobby Charlton acknowledged last night's events when he met the new owners.
I'm sorry about the trouble last night.
No, I
tried to get the message over, you know, and apologised for some of the behaviour of some of the fans. But generally speaking, you know, you've got to expect it. We are the biggest club in the world. We have more passion in our, with our fans than probably any other team. And it's just something that I felt I had to apologise for, because it's only football. This is we only play football. And really, violence has no place, really, in that. But I hope that they've had a really sensible look round. They've met everyone with regard to the club and how it's run, etc.
And just one more clip. That was interesting, I thought, to hear a club legend kind of, you know, say it's only football and, you know, kind of a...
I feel bad almost listening to that clip, because it like, looking at where we are now, it has not really aged well.
No, it hasn't. But I'll tell you something that really has aged well. Sir Bobby lays out two scenarios at the end of this clip for how he thinks it's going to go under the Glazers. So let's take a listen.
The Glazer family taking charge at Manchester United financially is another part of the club's history. It's another step, and probably people will look back on it later and say, well, that was one of the worst things we ever did, or one of the best things, but it's certainly going to be different. But we are a football club, and that will not change. And Manchester United, in the way that people have an affection for this club, Manchester United, will not change either. And I think that there'll be a lot less interference, if interference is probably the wrong word, from the Glazer family than most people had expected.
I think those scenarios ended up, Andrew, as scenario A for the hardcore supporters. This didn't turn out well.
No.
This was the worst thing that happened to their club, in their opinion.
Yeah. Look, I don't know where this goes from here. I don't know that, like, there's nothing that can really happen short of the Glazers selling, which I do not anticipate happening.
But Andrew,
that will satisfy the fan base.
This thing has appreciated in value. It's got bigger in value since they bought United. And a lot of it is true to the commercial work that they've done themselves. Mm-hmm. And they can come into the club and they can withdraw money from the club in their dividend. They're not getting rid of this. It's going to take. Now, the only thing is, you think how expensive it is to have a football match for Sky to show the Premier League is an expensive thing. And you wonder what happens if another one of these games is called off. That would be close to like 30 million in burned up, you know? So maybe the pressure comes from somewhere else.
But these games will be replayed.
Yeah, I know. But at some point, you run out of space in the calendar. Like, this is already going to mess with potentially mess with United's plans, considering they're at the latter stages of European competition. But I don't know what happens from here. Yeah. But a huge statement was made by the supporters on Sunday. There's no question.
It really was, and in many ways, you know, obviously they were speaking for themselves. This was a Manchester United issue, like Mark told us. But by the same token, I think that there were supporters of a lot of the other English clubs involved with the Super League breakaway that were cheering this on. I know Tottenham has a protest planned for May 15th, which is not the day of a match. I think it's the day before a match. But I would imagine there will be a significant turnout for that protest against their ownership group. I know Arsenal have been extremely vocal in their protests. And like we've talked about with Daniel Ek, they're even in the process of trying to actually find a buyer. Now, Stan Kroenke says that he's not interested in selling. Of course, he's going to be saying that right now. I tend to believe him. I don't think he is interested at this moment. But when push comes to shove, and if that money is put in front of him, and he knows how hated he is, he knows what an incredible headache this was. I do imagine, like I say all the time, willing to be hated. That's one thing. But like, this is probably an amazing headache for somebody who's getting a little bit older and probably wants to enjoy life more than whatever this is right now.
The front of the Kroenke movement is his son Josh. Mm-hmm. So, and Josh seems to have full of energy, and has issued a statement last week saying they have no interest in selling. So,
yeah. Oh, what a mess!
Unbelievable. It's been the most incredible month. Incredible. I mean, and it's not been on the field mostly.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, some of this, I feel. the Super League was obviously the match that lit the gasoline canister. I mean, that has set off this wave of change. And I guess I give these fans credit for recognizing the moment. Like if change is going to come about, it could only be in a moment like this, where something like this happened. The fans made their voices heard. UEFA, in some ways, I guess, had the fans back on this. So if the moment for change is now, and these fan groups are doing all they can to try and capitalize on this moment and instill the sorts of changes that they want, it's an uphill battle. I mean, my God, we'd like to think the sport belongs to the fans, but there's so many examples and instances where we're not sure that's true. This may not be one of them. And so fans are doing all they can right now to seize what could potentially be their moment. And the other thing, JJ, that I think about when I see some of this, I'm not saying any of the anger that fans are showing right now is without warrant or isn't genuine. Of course it is. We were feeling it. I mean, my God, we did 3 emergency podcasts in 3 days, and two of them, we were almost in tears talking about this. So, obviously this is all genuine. But, you and I were talking a little bit off air about like the game this past year, while it has been a nice distraction during the pandemic, it has also not been the same. And seeing your team score important last minute goals to decide games and secure 3 points without seeing fans in stadiums, there has been a joylessness to even the most joyous moments. And whether that has seeped into some people's minds subliminally or more overtly, I don't know, but I do believe that just like not seeing this sport in the way and manner that we're accustomed to seeing it, with the sounds and sights that we're accustomed to seeing with it, I can't help but think that that has had some kind of impact in terms of just like the anger, frustration, and buildup, which again culminated with the ultimate moment of anger and frustration with the Super League announcement. I just think all these things are factors.
Yeah, and maybe we have to consider in the way the Premier League has gone as well, with relegation pretty much sorted, probably top four sorted, and Manchester City, excuse me, running away with the title. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of games that aren't going to mean very much. And we're anxious to get to the end of this season, incredibly, yeah, as much as we love things. And we'll probably look to get our kicks in the EFL Championship playoffs, and watching Peterborough United claim promotion last week into the Championship, things like that. Maybe we need to get more grounded, Andrew, get a bit more zen, a bit more grassroots.
Maybe JJ, let's see, before we get out, we've gone super long here, and our thanks again to Mark Critchley for going in the club with us. Read his stuff at The Independent, check him out on Twitter, he's great covering this. We thank him. Before we get out, it's worth mentioning a former Manchester United manager, and a manager most recently with Tottenham, JJ, Jose Mourinho. He has once again landed on his feet. I mean, look, his resume is what it is. He's going to get jobs. And now his road has taken him back to Italy, this time with Roma.
Yes. Interesting to note that it's American ownership that's hired Jose Mourinho. Dan Friedkin is the Roma owner. He took over from James Pallotta last year. He's a Hollywood film financier, also, I believe, a car dealer of some note in the Gulf States. So he's a very rich man. But of course, Spurs fans will want to know, how does this affect us? Well, Tancredi Palmieri has said Mourinho has signed a 3-year contract at Roma for a total of 39 million euros net that will be paid in this way. 21-22 season, 7 million euro by Roma, 9 million by Spurs. 2022-23, 7 million euros by Roma, 9 million euros by Spurs. And for the final season of his contract, 23-24, the 7 million will be paid entirely by Roma. So Spurs are going to be on the hook for 18 million over the next 2 seasons, which I think is just incredible. I just want to quickly read this from Dan Friedkin and his vice president, Ryan Friedkin. We are thrilled and delighted to welcome Jose Mourinho into the AS Roma family. A great champion who has won trophies at every level, Jose will provide tremendous leadership and experience to our ambitious project. The appointment of Jose is a huge step in building a long-term and consistent winning culture throughout the club. It's as if they don't know much about Jose Mourinho.
When I saw this, I immediately thought of two guys on that Roma team, Chris Smalling and Henrik Mkhitaryan. Oh. And they must have been like, oh, here we go again.
Are you serious? We literally left a league, an entire league, to get away from this guy. And now he's back. Mkhitaryan in particular. Like, yeah. I mean, Smalling too, but Mkhitaryan in particular. Like, how he was kind of frozen out, one of Jose's casualties of at the United reign. I mean, oh,
that's one of those transfers to this day. You know, we whenever transfers happen, we get some right, we get some wrong on what we think will work, what won't. That's one of my all-time wrong. I felt so good about that move, Mkhitaryan. I thought so highly of him, and it just didn't. And now he's
he's got to go. He's got to go. He's in his early 30s. He needs to find another place, yeah, another landing spot, because you just know the way it's going to go with this guy.
Yep. Speaking of got to go, I would say we got to go, my friend.
I think so too.
This has been a beast. I had the Union Atlanta United FC CONCACAF Champions League game on in front of me, kind of on my phone. Right now it's 1-0. Atlanta have pulled one back. So it's still 3-1 on aggregate in favor of the Union. And as I've said before, in instances when we are recording while a game that I care about is happening, if you're listening to this now and the Union lost, just know that I'm horrified. Later tonight, Toronto FC in action, trying to overturn a 3-1 deficit also against Cruz Azul.
And we'll get to talk about Monterrey and Columbus and Club America and Portland on Thursday,
along with Chelsea and Real Madrid. And we will look ahead, of course, because this weekend is the big one in La Liga with Barcelona and Atletico Madrid. So, of course, we'll look ahead to that one. And JJ, we just mentioned so many things to talk about on Thursday's podcast. Is it a jump to conclusions week, or should we push that?
I don't know, Andrew. Maybe we won't have space. We'll have to plan that one out. But someone did say, don't even bother doing the jump to conclusions week if you don't have the Boeing.
Mm. Good point.
You better get your sound effects lined up, me old friend. Don't worry about mucker.
That. Don't worry about that. All right. You just worry about yourself. Hey, this was fun. Our thanks again to Mark Critchley from The Independent. JJ, good stuff, my friend. To you, I say.
Check you later, fun boy.
See ya.
Take care, my man.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.